I'm Dr. Vic McCracken, your host for the Cornerstone Podcast. Today we visit with Dr. Richard Beck, who is professor and chair of the psychology department at ACU. A professor at ACU since 1998, Beck's research specialties include the psychology of religion and the assessment and treatment of emotional disorders. His new book, Unclean, Meditations on Purity, Hospitality, and Mortality, will be published this spring. Dr. Beck, welcome to our show.
Well, it's good to be on. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I want to begin by asking you to answer the question that you had all of our students answer during your lecture today. So you asked us, can we love the sinner but hate the sin? What do you think?
The book that's coming out that you mentioned is based on research I've been doing for a few years. And so I've been thinking long and hard about that very question. And I guess I've been thinking about it since I was a kid. And I first, and I'll do a professorial thing and do a long preamble before I get,
sure,
to, before I get to the question. I think the thing that, when you see, when you look out at the culture wars is how it seems that some of these crusades for holiness, some of these crusades for righteousness, as people kind of, you know, protest, people who make controversial values decisions, be it related to same-sex attraction or abortion or things like that, that I've always just been concerned that some of those kind of crusades for holiness begin tipping into kind of almost a lack of compassion for the predicaments that people find in, and we begin to kind of dehumanize and demonize each other. And my sense is that whenever people are actually kind of really in the thick of relationship with, let's say, a young lady contemplating abortion, or they're talking with a family member who's dealing with same-sex attraction, or anything, right? You know, a friend who's a Republican dealing with another friend who's a Democrat. Whenever we disagree strongly about these things, but we're actually in relationship with the people that we disagree with, that seems like a lot of that toxic, angry culture war rhetoric seems to dissipate. And we begin to understand a little bit about why people are struggling with these choices. And it suddenly becomes real personal and becomes real human. And it seems like we reach a different place in those conversations. Martha Nussbaum, political legal philosopher, she talks about like a narrative approach to criminality. That if we understand stories, that we stop thinking is good versus evil. We start understanding the trajectory of where people come from. And that can't help but build some degree of empathy for the people that are, you know, even criminals and even maybe do pretty horrible things. But when you understand where they've come from, abuse that they might have endured and so on and so forth. So it prompted me to think that if we really love people, that even though we might be violently disagreeing about kind of maybe what they do, that there is a sense of compassion that comes about, and that sin doesn't come out of anywhere. And that the categories pure and impure and saint and sinner and clean and unclean, you know, often don't do us a good service. So anyway, from my research in psychology, I tend to argue for that these notions are all, like purity and love and disgust and contamination related to mercy are often reciprocal. As one goes up, the other goes down. But people often counter and they say, you know, I can hate addiction. You know, I can see it in a family member, and I hate this sin of addiction and what it's doing to my friend or my spouse and what it's doing to our family. And I hate that, but I still love them as a person. I think the thing that I'm focusing on when I talk about loving the sin and hating the sinner is how emotions of dehumanization creep in often. And so if it's framed that way, then I would say you can't hate the sin and love the sinner if the hating of the sin is involved in psychological processes that begin reducing the humanity of the other person. I think sometimes it is possible to have very strong feelings about something and keep the humanity of the person you disagree with protected. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I think a lot of the rhetoric we see is really engaging in the demonization of people. And that's really kind of what I want our students to wrestle with, is how that is occurring in their own hearts and minds. So in one sense, I would say, yes, it's possible to separate the behavior from the person. But in most cases, we don't do a very good job of that. And I think we need to be cautious about it.
Good. Yeah, I think that that's a very helpful response. It might actually point to the way that you answer the another question that your lecture raised for me. You talked a lot about how Jesus calls us to become people who, like him, desire mercy, not sacrifice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet the examples that you used pointed to how psychologically things are kind of weighted toward us being concerned about purity, mm-hmm. Desiring sacrifice, establishing boundaries to protect ourselves. So I'm assuming that if Jesus tells us to desire mercy, not sacrifice, that that's possible. And yet I'm still wrestling with how that actually happens. How do you become a person who actually does embody mercy for the other and not the sacrificial way that, that Jesus is calling us out of?
Yeah. Well, the thing before I is a kind of a preliminary to that. I think one of the things I'd like to say is that, you know, in the example I gave, you know, where the young lady was asked to spit in the cup and then reincorporate, you know, to drink what she spit in the cup and didn't want to do that. That's an actual that feeling that when something's left the territory of selfhood, it becomes other and foreign and alien, that hesitancy to reincorporate it is a protective mechanism, right? Worries about cleanliness and contamination and purity, the emotion of disgust and revulsion is protective. We shouldn't take in toxic things. And so I think there is a struggle there because it is at root a protective mechanism. And you see it even in Paul wrestling with moral failures in the Corinthian church about how he is calling for a bit of a quarantine in a case of sexual immorality there. And the question in those cases is, okay, there are going to be times when there have to be boundaries. And so I don't want to suggest that there shouldn't be any boundaries. What I'm concerned about is warning us that those boundaries, if they are not monitored and discerned, start this process of dehumanization. And that kind of leads into the answer, which is, how do you become a person of mercy? There's a famous quote from Levi Strauss, the anthropologist, that says, humanity ends at the border of the tribe. And in a certain way, our feelings of mercy follow our ontology, which means kindness follows our kin. They share the same root. Those we identify as kin, we extend kindness to, and everybody else outside of that circle is considered essentially a stranger. Peter Singer, the ethicist, talks about what he calls the moral circle, and how we draw a border around people that are considered to be my kind, they are the same as me, and that can be pretty fluid, you know. Some psychologists estimate it's actually a pretty bounded number, 150. So some people think that is kind of like the basic unit of human community. Any number gets beyond 150, it's hard to keep track of. If you look at, you know, the people you invite to weddings, it's usually a list of 150 from friends to family to whatever, kind of represents the people that I would drive to the airport. And they might feel like they could, you know, I might see them at my family reunion. And then beyond that are these other people that I only vaguely either know or they're complete strangers to me. How do I treat them? And Singer says the people inside the moral circle, 150 or not, we just intuitively extend, you know, kindness to them. We might do it begrudgingly, but as we say, you know, they're family. If they're in help, I'll help them. You know, I'll go there. But these other people are almost anonymous ciphers to us, and those people on the outside of the moral circle, Singer says, we just treat as instruments or obstacles in our life. And so, here's the way I illustrate with students. I say, you know, you have a friend who gets a job over at a restaurant, you know, and you're very excited for them because they've wanted this job. It's a busy restaurant, so they can make a lot of money. And so on the very first night that they're on the floor, you say, we're going to come over and we're going to sit in your section. You can wait on us. It'll be great. But when you get there, they're stressed out, they're tired, they're just completely run down. And so I asked my students, what do you say to this person? This is your best friend, and they're, you know, having a really bad first night waiting tables. You say easily, naturally, don't worry about us, right? You know, get to us last, take care of your customers, we'll sit here and just, you know. And as Jesus said, that's no great act of moral demonstration, right? Even the pagans, you know, are, treat their brothers and sisters, you know, in this fashion. It's just natural to do that. Because that friend is inside your moral circle. But if we just go out and there's this stranger waiting on us, and maybe they're stressed out, maybe they're not, we're not really paying attention, and they're not performing well, then we get angry and we complain and we don't tip and we write a bad comment card, you know. The point is that, you know, that waitress is somebody's daughter, somebody's mom, you know, she's inside somebody's moral circle. Mm-hmm. She's just not inside my moral circle. So for all practical purposes, I don't really care. So how do you become a person of mercy? Well, I think in the language of the church, we start extending this kinship language to people who are strangers, right? We wrestle with seeing this person in front of me not as an anonymous person, but somebody who is family. And I think at the heart of the Christian worship experience of the Lord's table, that's an amazing metaphor, saying we're all sitting around here. We're not related. You know, out in the world, we're not blood relatives, but around this, we share a universal family. And so I think the struggle is to expand the moral circle, to try to live in a world without strangers. And again, that's impossible, right? I mean, psychology, like you said, is always going to start narrowing. We're always going to start, like Strauss talks about, have a tribe, and that the people beyond that tribe, who knows what they're doing. And I think the easiest way to do that is empathy. Mm. I think that's the biggest way to expand the moral circle. And so I think that's one of the things that we wanted to do in Cornerstone and in the core curriculum or ACU generally, is just help students begin engaging different people, thinking about the world from different perspectives, because then you start seeing those people as very much like yourself. Carl Rogers, psychologist, says, is a quote I think about a lot. He goes, that which is most personal is most universal. And what he means is the things that we think we hold dearest to us, that are like most personal to me, the deeper I go into who Richard Beck is, are actually the things that begin uniting me with other people. We tend to differ in superficiality, superficial things. But when you really dig deep into a person, we ultimately really want the same things in life. And if you can get to that, I think you can humanize these anonymous interactions with people that we struggle with in the world. Long answer, but I think empathy and expanding the moral circle and living in a world without strangers is a beginning.
I like that. And I also like the way that you suggest that even an experience like in Cornerstone, where regularly students and professors are going to be engaging other voices, that in itself is a small piece of that journey that we are all going on to expand those boundaries. Mm-hmm. That's good.
And I think the thing that Christine is doing in the second spotlight week is a classic example of that. And we won't kind of let the cat out of the bag for that, but that's just a beginning of a beginning example of how we do that.
Excellent. Yeah. Let me ask you one more question, Dr. Beck. At the conclusion of your lecture today, you talked about this vision of Cornerstone, in which students would learn the ways that as Christians they can integrate Christian faith, the humanities, the arts, as well as the sciences. All of these things all of these things having a place at the table, mm-hmm. in our pursuit of truth, and that's a vision that really appeals to me. It's one of the things that got me into the academy, mm-hmm. just that interest in integrating different disciplines. And yet, one of the things that I've discovered as a Christian scholar is that sometimes science and faith and the humanities pull us in different directions.
Right.
They don't always seem to cohere.
There's
so
no one big answer.
That's
the end.
Right. So I'm wondering, as a Christian scholar, how do you handle that? Does Christian faith, does Scripture always is that always the trump card? Like, what do you do when you see tensions between the things that you read or the things that you're researching as a scientist and the things that the Christian tradition has long said are true, that science might call into question?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I've had to deal with is that I don't think that there is a final trump card that gets played with from faith, that ultimately everything we experience and learn affects that. They're all mutually affecting each other. And yeah, admittedly, it might be safer and cleaner to just not enter into conversation, to keep these worlds very separate. And I think that's been a model in many Christian universities, where there's kind of your religious classes and your Bible classes, and there's what you do in just a profession, and those two things stay separate. And we've decided to do something different at ACU, which is to bring those two things into conversation. And admittedly, that's a scary prospect because of exactly what you brought up. There's no easy answers there. I think that one of the things I stress to my students is that when faith and science collide, or when faith and human experience collide, that the outcome isn't going to ultimately be predictable, that we're not going to get one Christian perspective on it all, and that Christians interact with things like they have different views on that, like we've talked about mental illness. They have different views on, you know, the creation of the world. They have different views, and some integrate more with science, let the kind of the scientific worldview, it's accommodated. Some are less accommodating. Which one of those is Christian? You know, they both have distinctive Christian frames around them, but there's not one perspective there. So as I integrate psychology, when students say that, you know, prospective students come and say, how does ACU integrate psychology? I say, well, my faculty do it all. They do it very differently, and they disagree a great deal. Ultimately, you're going to have to decide how you integrate that. And so your question, what do you do, is really less a question about what will we do, but really what you as a person will do. I think the most important thing is to realize that it's very much a journey. I think you can maybe early on feel like you kind of make certain moves to integrate and revisit them later and go, maybe that wasn't the best way to do it, and reach. I think it's going to be an ongoing process. I think ultimately, though, all the processes for me ultimately end with being a cross-centered person. And if anything's pulling me away from that, then to me that's the biggest alarm bell in my mind. If it's causing me to follow another way, another path, then I worry about that. But how I arrange the furniture oftentimes is not really in play. And I think that's the biggest thing to realize for students, is to learn what's critical of all these fab bits of this tapestry, or all the furniture that can be moved. You know, what are the load-bearing walls, and what can we safely fiddle with? Because sometimes I think we're confused about really what is the load-bearing wall, what's not, and it feels like we're taking a hammer and knocking things down and the whole thing's going to collapse, but it's not. But there's a lot of anxiety during those times, and I think that's the biggest discernment. What are the non-negotiables for us at ACU? What's the non-negotiables for you? And I have my non-negotiables, things that, you know, I'm going to stick with, and I mentioned a little bit of what that looks like in being a disciple of Jesus. But I agree that that process is kind of scary at times. And a lot of times what we have to learn to do is help students through that anxiety and realize that this is a safe place. Faculty are on this journey, they're on the journey, and they're not alone. And that there's no one final place where they need to land. It's the process that's more important than anything else.
That's good. Well, Dr. Beck, I want to thank you for coming to our studio today.